Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, while our state begins to ease restrictions meant to slow the spread of COVID-19, the Wind River Reservation remains under a stay-at-home order.
We do everything that we can to keep them home, to keep them safe, to keep them sheltered in whatever it is that we need to do, and keep them healthy for the most part.
Also, as Wyoming slowly begins to reopen its economy, experts say people need to be careful of a false sense of security by looking at the number of coronavirus cases in their counties.
I think that it's important that people be aware that there are likely more cases than we diagnose.
And summer usually signals the start of Wyoming's wedding season, but this year things will probably look very different.
It does affect our business big time, and it worries me.
Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming is one of the states with the fewest number of COVID-19 lab-confirmed cases. That's good news. But officials say the state still needs to be careful and not fall into a false sense of security that could cause a second wave and end up being disastrous to the health and economy of the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kadelska reports.
I had what seemed like a really sore throat and some chest tightness. It felt like someone was sitting on my chest. It wasn't hard to breathe, but taking a deep breath was very taxing. And when I did, I had a cough.
At the end of March, Curtis Harnish started getting sick. As he started feeling worse, he realized his symptoms were aligned with COVID-19. When he had a temperature, he finally decided to call his doctor.
I say, hey, these are the symptoms I'm feeling. And she's like, well, it definitely sounds like you have it, but I can't test you. We don't have a test, and if we did, we wouldn't use it on you.
So Harnish was told to quarantine for 2 weeks and go to the emergency room if the shortness of breath got worse.
Once I stopped having a fever, my energy started coming back and I started feeling a lot more normal.
After about 12 days of quarantine, Harnish was on the mend and he feels good today. But he's now skeptical of the number of COVID-19 cases by county that the Wyoming Department of Health provides. So are a lot of people, because they know of likely cases that are not being counted. Wyoming Health Officer Dr. Alexia Harris says that's likely.
I think that it's important that people be aware that there are likely more cases than we've diagnosed and really take that into consideration going forward.
Harris stresses that even if your county has zero or one case, it does not mean you're safe. So why do we not have the accurate numbers of COVID-19 cases in the state? Well, there are a couple of factors. First, Park County Health Officer Dr. Aaron Billen says there is a possibility that the COVID-19 test could be giving false negatives.
I can think of a handful of cases in Park County that were tested and were negative, and we're thinking they were a false negative because they had the contacts and they had the symptoms.
Second, for a couple of weeks, the state didn't have enough tests to test everyone, so only those on the Department of Health priority list were being tested. Those were people over 65 and others that had risk factors, so Billen agrees with those who think the numbers are off.
We suspect cases in most communities in Park County that haven't been diagnosed yet. We anticipate more diagnosed cases in Park County as we approach the peak.
The Department of Health is trying to improve things by keeping track of people who have been in contact with a confirmed case and develop symptoms, whether or not they've been tested. The department is calling these probable cases. And some counties are keeping track of one more thing. Campbell County Health Director Jane Glosser.
A possible positive is somebody who's symptomatic but has not been tested and has not been deemed a close contact of an actual positive person.
Possible cases are recommended to self-quarantine. Glosser says keeping track of possible cases help people realize that there's probably more COVID-19 cases in their community.
And we just have found it's a really good way to help alleviate some fears within symptomatic patients.
All of this to say, people shouldn't fall into a false sense of security if their county has few coronavirus cases. State Health Officer Dr. Alexia Harris says people should be especially aware of this as the state starts reopening the economy.
All of the social distancing, wearing face coverings, staying home when you're sick can help prevent transmission in the cases that we may have not diagnosed because they didn't have access to a test.
But Harris says widespread testing is critical, and the state is working to increase that. During a recent press conference, she said easing restrictions has to be slow.
Our first steps forward must be smaller steps that involve lower risk and fewer people. But we need more time to see how this disease may progress overall and how each of our moves forward will affect Wyoming.
If the state starts seeing more cases, there is a chance that they would have to close some things down again. Governor Mark Gordon said it best. That would be more devastating to Wyoming than it is now. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kodalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Our state is one of a handful that never issued a stay-at-home order to slow the spread of COVID-19. But the two tribes on the Wind River Reservation have taken a different approach. Tribal members face fines and even jail time for violating a stay-at-home order there. And as Wyoming begins to lift statewide restrictions, the reservation is locking down even tighter. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports.
It's a chilly April day on Wind River.
Good morning, afternoon, everyone.
And the Eastern Shoshone Tribal Health Department is hard at work.
We're up here in Kerhart, Wyoming. I'm in a big wind hall right now with a food and supply distribution.
In a Facebook Live video, Director David Myers pans over to a truck bed full of groceries.
We even got fresh fruit and hamburger to give out with this distribution. Also, we have cereal, flour, so stop on by.
Crowheart is one of Wind River's more remote communities, about 30 miles from a full-service grocery store. So these food distributions have been a big help. And co-chairwoman Karen Snyder of the Eastern Shoshone Business Council says they're just one way the tribe is helping folks comply with the stay-at-home order.
We do everything that we can to keep them home, to keep them safe, to keep them sheltered in whatever it is that we need to do, and keep them healthy for the most part.
The tribes have teamed up to protect their members from the illness itself and from the economic fallout of the pandemic. They're providing meals, supplies, even quarantine housing for those who need it. The Northern Arapaho Tribes Clinic has tested more than 3,000 people from both tribes for COVID-19. That's about 30% of all the tests conducted in Wyoming.
I just think that, you know, we value our membership.
And their membership is especially vulnerable during this pandemic. Stephen Fasthorse is Snyder's counterpart with the Northern Arapaho Tribe. He says neglect by the federal government has led to health disparities on Wind River.
Tribes across the nation have inadequate health care, you know, even though there's a trust responsibility of the federal government to provide the health care for the reservations as part of their treaty obligations.
High rates of illnesses like asthma and heart disease put tribal members at risk for COVID-19. And due to underfunding of tribal housing programs, those at-risk individuals are also more likely to live in overcrowded homes where the disease could spread quickly.
You have maybe three, sometimes even four families staying under one roof.
Fasthorse says this is why the tribes have responded so much more proactively and aggressively than the county and the state that surround Wind River. Still, they've already lost community members. On April 20th, four Northern Arapaho tribal members died from COVID-19, the largest number of deaths in any one Wyoming community.
These tribal members were our family members who were dearly loved.
That's Chairman Lee Spoonhunter of the Northern Arapaho Tribe, addressing the community on social media.
Many of you continue to discard the safety of our elders by not adhering to these measures and continue to put your parents and your grandparents at risk. Your grandparents love you unconditionally and depend on the love you have for them to conduct yourself and behave in a proper way.
A few days later, there were rallies around Wyoming to protest the few statewide restrictions put in place by the governor to slow the spread of COVID-19. State Representative Andy Clifford, whose district encompasses much of the reservation, says there wasn't a rally on Wind River. She says her constituents are more comfortable with the idea of making a sacrifice on behalf of the community.
The sense of urgency for us as tribal people, as Indigenous people, to take care of our people. One death was one too many for us.
Clifford says there's been one ugly consequence to the two tribes' aggressive strategy. More testing means a higher rate of confirmed COVID-19 cases on the reservation. And some border town residents have been twisting that data and blaming Native people for the spread of the illness in Fremont County. This despite the county's first outbreak being reported at a Lander retirement center.
These racist comments and actions were going to occur. It's just a matter of when. And unfortunately, started because of the four deaths, which is just unfortunate. But it doesn't surprise me.
If there's a silver lining to all of this, tribal leaders say it's a renewed intertribal partnership. Co-chairwoman Snyder of the Eastern Shoshone Business Council says the Northern Arapaho Tribes Clinic has taken over medical and public health oversight for both tribes.
Windover Cares has really stepped up, and it's been a true blessing, the collaboration that this has brought forward.
And co-chairman Fast Horse of the Northern Arapaho Business Council says they're tag-teaming every problem that arises.
That's been something that I'm very proud of, you know, is that we've been able to reestablish that connection and strengthen that connection.
Fast Horse added that the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes are no stranger to a crisis. This isn't the first time they've battled a strange illness or racism or been forced to adjust to a drastically new reality. For better or for worse, he says the tribes have the tools to survive this. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr on the Wind River Reservation.
When we come back, we'll explore what will be a different wedding season this year. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Summer's coming up, which usually means people are getting ready for wedding season. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Megan Feary reports, this summer will be very different.
Susie Pouliot recently got engaged. She and her fiancé wanted to have the ceremony as soon as possible, and that's because of her dad, who's terminally ill.
So our thought was all about what can we do in this shorter time frame to include my dad, knowing that when we have our actual wedding, he likely will not be able to be there.
Susie's father has cancer, and she doesn't know how much longer he has.
Actually, it's his fourth round with cancer, and he has been fighting like crazy for the past 5 years.
Treatment was no longer an option, and her father went into hospice care. So Susie and her fiancé chose a date, April 18th, and started calling vendors. Weddings are a lot of work to plan. Designing invitations, getting a dress, scheduling a venue. But Susie managed to do it all in just a few weeks. She and her fiancé both come from big families, and getting them all together was not easy. But somehow they managed it. And then
it became more and more like, okay, this could be a risky situation.
So they canceled the ceremony, which broke Susie's heart.
The part that was very important to me was to have pictures of my dad walking me down the aisle.
Having to cancel or reschedule a wedding affects everyone involved. Vendors lose their source of income, families don't get to come together and celebrate, and couples miss out on what is supposed to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience. For Susie, part of the healing process is acknowledging that her feelings are valid.
This heartbreak, it's a loss of a dream that I had of having my dad walk me down the aisle. And that's no greater nor lesser than somebody else's heartbreak when they're worrying about how they're going to sustain their livelihood.
Susie may never get those pictures she dreamed of. One thing she had to cancel was her wedding photographer, Janelle Rose. Rose said that at the start of the year, things were really looking up for her business.
We looked at 2020 as one of our biggest years. It's a very catchy year. We had a lot of couples booking early, and our dates went really quickly.
And then suddenly, those same couples had to cancel or postpone. And it was scary.
It does affect our business big time, and it worries me.
And there's good reason to worry. Wyoming's wedding season is relatively short, but with about 4,000 weddings jammed into it a year, many people make their living off them. But for Rose, the loss is about so much more.
You know, I've been looking back through, and we make these little slideshows of each wedding day, and it's just so painful to look through some of that right now, because I mean, you see so many people touching and being together and celebrating, and it's just, we're having to grieve what's lost and what we took for granted.
Kelly Renee agrees. She's a bridal hairstylist and makeup artist in Jackson Hole. It's a really popular destination for weddings in the state.
Summer is my bread and butter financially. I make most of my income for the year within about a 5-month period.
And because of Wyoming's long and unpredictable winters, most weddings happen between late May and September. A summer of canceled weddings could be financially devastating.
So it definitely affects being able to pay bills. I mean, usually summertime is where I can get ahead and I can put some money back and save. And then that way during my slower season, it kind of carries me through that.
But some people are still trying to keep a positive attitude. Kate Denisova was supposed to tie the knot on March 28th in Jackson Hole, but had to cancel everything at the last minute. She and her fiance were going to get married and then celebrate in style.
My fiance bought a tuxedo, which was several sizes too big to put over his ski gear. I bought extremely like poofy 80s style wedding dress. I got a veil to put on my helmet. So we're going to dress up and ski in our wedding costumes.
Since they were stuck inside on what was supposed to be their big day, they made do.
We dressed up in our costumes and had a nice dinner at home and took pictures and came up with a new relationship status called Almost Married.
Denisova says that being stuck at home together with nothing to do is good practice for when they're older.
We're doing things backwards. You know, we're experiencing retirement first and then the wedding.
And she's really trying to make the best of a bad situation.
I think the best you can do is just laugh.
Kate and her fiance have decided to postpone their ceremony until things stabilize. So for now, the future is uncertain. But there's always light at the end of the aisle. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Megan Feary.
Now to discuss the opposite of weddings. One listener recently wrote to us to ask about recommendations for parenting if you're separated or divorced during the pandemic. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie reached out to both a family law attorney and some folks that are navigating the issue.
I catch Holly Spriggs on her cell phone outside of Lander, Wyoming. She and her teenage son, Sawyer, are spending the afternoon in her giant garden.
Working on planting some potatoes and onions before we get some moisture here.
Spriggs is having a great time, but Sawyer would rather be doing something else.
Snowmobiling.
Snowmobiling, he says, is way more fun than planting a garden. That's a chore. His mom laughs.
But he's a good help.
Spriggs has been taking care of both Sawyer and his older brother, Wyatt, for the past 3 weeks. It's a special circumstance. Normally, she and her ex-husband share parenting duties. 1 week at their dad's, 1 week at their mom's. But like everything else, COVID-19 has shaken up those plans.
There's not really like a user's guide that comes with co-parenting during a pandemic.
Taking care of the kids is challenging enough without the novel coronavirus. But throw in stay-at-home recommendations, school closings, the stress of maybe losing your job or working from home. It's a lot. Family law attorney Bobby Batley.
The challenges that were present in co-parenting are generally more heightened by something like a pandemic.
Batley runs a law firm in Albuquerque. She says the novel coronavirus is exposing all of the cracks and fissures in parenting plans for those who are divorced and separated. For some, those cracks are small.
Most parents that had a good co-parenting relationship where they were, you know, good communicators, they were open and flexible and generous and supportive of the children's relationship with each parent are doing fairly well.
But on the other hand,
this is a rare opportunity for us to see, you know, kind of the warts of people fully magnified.
Batley says those warts run the gamut, from fights over how to homeschool the kids to situations where parents are taking advantage of these uneasy times to try and gain more custody.
they're kind of using this as an opportunity to further restrict time and contact with that parent. And I think those have been really sad.
When those collapses in co-parenting happen, lawyers like Batley will try and hold out-of-court mediations over Zoom. And she says, family therapists are even traveling to clients' homes and visiting with both parents and kids, albeit through windows to keep safe. But if things really get rough and there are instances of violence or abuse, she says the courts in her state are always available, even during a pandemic.
Our Supreme Court's taken a pretty, you know, stringent stand toward domestic violence and toward emergency custody orders. And so our judges pretty much throughout the state of New Mexico are setting emergency hearings and or having, you know, quick status conferences or phone conferences.
The same is true for other states in the Mountain West. Courts are available for emergencies. But Batley says most situations can be solved out of court. In fact, judges are encouraging families to work with each other and to be flexible right now.
For the most part, courts aren't going to follow you around and look and see what you're doing in your house. You know, so if something makes sense to the two parents and it's all about making that child or that the children in that family comfortable and happy and it's in their best interest, you know, then I think a court's going to be very amenable to anybody doing that.
That's what Holly Spriggs and her ex-husband are trying to do. They're one of the luckier couples and have a good co-parenting relationship. They're being flexible. Back in mid-March, they thought it was best to split up their two sons, Wyatt and Sawyer. One was at their dad's, one was at their mom's, so everyone could self-isolate.
Even though that was really hard, like, it was just the best thing that we could think of at the time to kind of slow the transmission.
But now both kids are at their mom's house, mostly because she works from home right now and she can help them with schoolwork.
Also, living a little ways out of town kind of helps with teenagers wanting to run off and hang out with their friends.
That means Sawyer and Wyatt are, at least for now, stuck at home helping mom plant potatoes. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Up next, we'll have a discussion about COVID-19 testing and then change gears to talk about climate change discussions in Congress. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. As Wyoming slowly begins to reopen, the Department of Health says widespread testing is critical. In the simplest terms, the COVID-19 test works by taking a sample from a potentially infected individual and it's scanned for the virus. But it turns out, like any other test, the COVID-19 test is not 100% accurate. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudowska spoke with University of Wyoming Associate Professor of Community and Public Health, Dr. Christine Porter, about why it matters that there is a possibility of false negatives.
How can these false negatives happen? So, you know, in Wyoming, we're a large state. These samples are being transported for a long time and stuff like that. So does that factor into those potential false negatives?
So let me just say, everything about the coronavirus is a little bit still up for grabs, right? We're increasing the science and our knowledge, but there's still so much we don't know. I'm going to assume, with good reason, I think, that people know what they're doing in terms of transporting the samples and in running the labs. It seems that the main source of false negatives, like you actually have it, but the test doesn't show you have it, is that we're not able to get a good enough sample of the body fluids that actually contains the virus that's in your body. So almost all the samples, if not all of them in Wyoming, are, to my knowledge, they're sticking the swabs up deep up your nose and doing a swab up at the top, high up in your nose. Very uncomfortable. I understand. Also, we have a shortage of swabs, at least sometimes in some parts of the country. And it's dangerous for the person taking the sample, right? If the person is positive, sticking that up their nose, they're up close and personal, can make them sneeze and cough, which obviously makes the spread the virus. So there's a lot of personal protective equipment needed on the part of the sampler in addition. So it's not an easy process. And if your viral load, if you have the virus, but it's a relatively low level of infection, you have mild symptoms, maybe even none, it's even harder to pick up the virus. So if you don't, you might have it in your body, but if you don't get it on that sample, it's going to test negative, even though the virus might be in your body. So mild cases are less likely to show up positive because they're less likely to catch it on the sample that they take. Also, cases that are farther out from infection, the infection level, the amount of virus in your body might be decreasing. And so those also, those cases might also give you a false positive, even though they have the virus and maybe spreading it.
So I know that there's been some research out there that gives a wide rate of sensitivity for those tests.
There are almost no tests that are 100% sensitive, right? There's no, like, perfection is not a thing, especially in biology. Probably at most, these tests are like 95 to 98% sensitive. Let's say that our tests are 95% sensitive. That means that only 5% of tests will have a false negative. However, let's say that that's actually a decent sensitivity rate. Let's say it's 95%. That would mean that among the almost 9,000 negative results we've had so far in Wyoming, right? We've done over 9,000 tests, 404 so far have been positive. 8,895 tests have been negative. That implies that 5% of those are not actually negative of those 8,800. That would give us a total case rate that's way more than double the 404, just among the people we have tested so far who have had negative results. Some of the studies coming out that have compared methods of sampling and testing have found sensitivity rates that are as low as 72% for the nasal swabs, which means 28% of tests would have false negatives. That implies we have actually 9 times as many cases as the 404 we currently have listed. We don't know for sure what how well we're doing with that.
Why should Wyomingites care about the fact that there is this possibility of the sensitivity being pretty high? Or even just that there is a sensitivity, you know, that 5% rate, 95%.
A few reasons. One is at the individual level. If you were one of the few people to get a test and it comes back negative, you can't be sure you're negative. If you have symptoms, you should assume you actually do have COVID and quarantine accordingly and contact trace accordingly. The other issue, at a more public health level, we've done a phenomenal job of social distancing and doing other prevention measures. But as soon as those start to lift, the spread starts to go up. And the more people we have who are infected, the faster that's going to happen. And so if we're making public policy, assuming we only have 400 people who have it instead of 2,000, 3,000 people who have it, then it's going to, and we lift social distancing and other restrictions too soon, we're going to be really fast into a fire that's raging way higher than what we've been able to prevent.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudalska speaking with University of Wyoming Community and Public Health Associate Professor Dr. Christine Porter. Changing gears, before coronavirus shut down much of the U.S. economy, leaders in the Republican Party were slowly adapting their policies to address climate change because young folks of all stripes say they want elected leaders to address it. But as Matt Laszlo reports from Washington, Wyoming lawmakers are torn on how their party should address the political and scientific problem.
Coronavirus hasn't just upended most of our lives. The global pandemic has upended entire industries, and the oil and gas sector is getting pummeled from multiple fronts. Besides losing workers to quarantining and some who've contracted the virus, the industry's had to watch the price of its products plummet because Saudi Arabia and Russia were locked in a high-stakes game of chicken over the price of oil. But, to be fair, prices have also fallen because fewer people are on the roads or in the skies. Wyoming U.S. Senator John Barrasso says they're bracing.
There is a direct and long-term impact that will ultimately, we will get through this. We are a strong and resilient state, and this is a state built on people with drive and determination. Our best days are still ahead.
After Democrats recaptured the House of Representatives in the 2018 midterms, many top GOP leaders recognized a massive flaw in their strategy. Polls show younger independents and Republicans care about combating climate change, which doesn't quite mesh with the more than 90 environmental regulations President Trump and Republicans have rolled back. Barrasso is a part of GOP leadership in the Senate and knows the party's been walking a tightrope since the midterms.
You know, as a senator from Wyoming, where oil and gas is our bread and butter, and as somebody who believes in the science of climate, I'm focused on finding ways through innovation that we can address the climate challenges that our world is facing without taxation and penalization.
While House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy has recognized the peril facing the GOP unless they win over those who care about climate change, one of his top generals in his leadership ranks, Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney, isn't quite there.
So when you talk about, you know, what you want to be able to do in an effort to combat climate change, we feel it's very important that that be based on facts, not be based on a continuation of the Obama era war on fossil fuels.
In his State of the Union address, President Trump endorsed an international proposal to plant 1 trillion trees to help capture carbon. But that doesn't go far enough for environmentalists and most Democrats. Still, Senator Barrasso helped kill a bipartisan energy bill that proponents called a down payment on combating climate change. Louisiana Republican Senator John Kennedy and Delaware Democrat Tom Carper tried to use that bill to phase out hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, that are currently in many refrigerators and AC units. Carper says it's a no-brainer.
And there are 16 Republican co-sponsors of the bill, 16 Democrats, and that's it has $3.7 billion worth of benefits for consumers. It's worth a half degree Celsius in this century in terms of climate change.
Even though the Senate energy legislation included more than 50 bills from more than 60 senators, Barrasso and other GOP leaders helped drive a stake in the legislation, which ultimately failed last month. Carper says it's incomprehensible because even GOP-friendly organizations like the Chamber of Commerce support the effort.
I mean, there's a lot of reasons to vote for it. The Chamber's for it, NAMA, the National Association of Manufacturers for it, the environmentalists are for it. And why can't we find a way to yes on a proposal that's good for job creation?
Barrasso, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and others in the GOP oppose the measure because they want to slash even more regulations, not ban commonly used household appliances. Barrasso says caring for the environment and American manufacturers aren't mutually exclusive.
We need energy security, economic growth, environmental stewardship.
Still, a growing number of Republicans are now calling to address the long-term threats climate change poses to the environment, including former Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney.
Long-term, to deal with our global climate issues, we're going to have something even more expansive.
Barrasso says moderate Republicans and progressives alike are making the perfect the enemy of the good.
Well, it's always interesting when people say, well, I'm going to vote against something because it doesn't go far enough. You know, I'm one of these folks. I say if something is moving in the direction that I think we ought to move in, then I tend to support those things unless it includes areas that really are harmful.
Even before coronavirus shuttered many local economies and grounded many airplanes, Congresswoman Liz Cheney dismissed calls to clean the nation's air from her fellow Republicans. She says sweeping proposals like Progressive's Green New Deal are unrealistic.
You know, I think we reflect the vast majority of the American people's viewpoint, which is recognizing that those sorts of solutions, eliminating air travel, eliminating the use of all fossil fuels is just, you know, simply a fantasy and wrong.
Fantasy or not, for now, it feels like many of us are quarantined in another world. And scientists and environmentalists keep warning that unless Congress acts swiftly, we all may soon be facing a new globe, one with more floods, wildfires, and intense storms. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
National Donate Life Month just wrapped up. Every April, advocates celebrate and recognize organ, eye, and tissue donation, something anyone can sign up to do at the time of their death. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with Raya O'Neill from Wyoming's Donor Alliance.
So Donor Alliance is the organ procurement organization that services the area of Colorado and most of Wyoming. So what we do is when someone has said yes to organ, eye, and tissue donation and they pass away, we then do the recovery. So we recover those organs, eye, and or tissue. And for the eye, it's cornea tissue. We recover those and then facilitate the transportation of those organs, eyes, and tissues to transplant centers and or tissue processors.
Colorado's a big state, lots of major medical facilities. But in Wyoming, are there a lot of hospitals that do organ transplants?
In Wyoming, we have none.
Okay, so you would have to travel out of state.
Yes, I would say as much as probably 75% of the people in Wyoming that end up getting listed, they get listed at a center in Denver. Just in the Metro Denver area, there's 4 transplant centers. We just don't have the population to support one.
And since you all manage the donor registry, how many people in Wyoming or what kind of percentage are registered organ donors?
In Wyoming, 63% of us say yes to organ, eye, and tissue donation. That actually puts Wyoming in about the top 5 in the nation.
What are some of the biggest myths there are out there or concerns that aren't true about organ donation?
The number one thing that I hear in Wyoming is I'm too old or I'm too sick. And we always educate people that you're never too old and you're never too sick. As a matter of fact, some of the oldest donors that we've had in our region are up in the 100s year of age. That's amazing that they're still able to be tissue donors and or cornea donors. And so we really encourage people, don't rule yourself out. Please let those medical professionals make that decision at the time of your death. You can always help by saying yes and keeping yourself on that donor registry every time you go to driver services.
Yeah, because it doesn't mean that everything's going to get used or that it will. Like it, there's a lot of factors that go into it.
One thing that people need to keep in the back of their mind is you hear about all these amazing scientific and healthcare advances that happen over the years of your life. You may not be aware of the ones that enable you to be a donor. We have people that have diabetes, for example, and some people think if they have an illness or a disease that they cannot be a donor, but they still can. Even some people with cancer can still be a donor. And so we want them to just not rule themselves out. Don't believe in those myths. Learn the facts and all of those they can look at donatelifewyoming.org and they can learn the facts of donation and keep themselves on that registry.
Tell me a little bit about how the education component of this got started and why it happens, really.
By state statute, we're tasked with educating the public about donation and really what it means when people say yes. And so over the years, we've done a lot of education through driver services in Wyoming. So you'll know when you go in and you renew your license, you see our marketing materials, you see educational brochures. We also train the staff there. And over time, we came to realize that mom and dad and child were going in to get their permits at 15 in Wyoming, and the kid would go, whoa, what is this question? And then they'd look at mom and dad and go, what do I do? And mom and dad would go, oh, just mark no, we'll talk about it later. Because no parent wants to talk about or think about even their child passing away. I'm a parent and I get that, absolutely. And so that definitely is not